This is an audio archive edition of WINA's Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot, made available online by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network, cvillepodcast.com.
Kathy Thornton is Associate Dean in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at the University of Virginia, where she earned her Ph.D. in 1979. She is also a former NASA astronaut, and we are honored to welcome her to the program. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks.
You having a good summer?
Yeah, so far.
Good, good. How many times did you go into space?
I flew on the shuttle 4 times.
Space shuttle astronaut, 4 times. My gosh. Well, we definitely want to talk about that. But can we back up first and maybe get a Kathy Thornton 101, like just where you're from and just sort of a short sketch about where you're from and how you ended up in space?
Well, for the bottom line is I got really lucky. But to start from the beginning, I came from Montgomery, Alabama. I grew up there with 5 brothers and sisters and went to Auburn University as an undergrad and got a degree in physics and decided I didn't know enough to work in the field. So I came here to UVA for graduate school in physics, earned my PhD, and they finally made me get out and get a job. So I worked for the Army for a while in what was the Foreign Science and Technology Center here in Charlottesville, now NGIC.
Right, right.
And saw an announcement that NASA was selecting the next group and thought, what the heck? All I can do is say no.
What did you have to go through? Because we see in the movies, you know, they have to, you know, stand on their head all day and do these crazy stunts. And what was it like, the selection process?
Well, first putting in an application, and then I forgot about it. I thought there's no chance in the world. And then they called me down for an interview. And interestingly enough, I was reading the book, The Right Stuff, on the airplane down to Houston, thinking, how badly do I really want to do this? But, you know, as it turns out, in those days, they didn't know what to look for, so they looked for everything. Now, we pretty much know what experiences the crews will have in orbit, and so the testing is much more focused, and most of the unpleasant things didn't happen to me.
Right, right. So tell me about when you found out. Do you remember where you were when you found out the news that you had been selected?
I was in Washington. I was at the Pentagon working some Army business there, and I got a call saying, you want to come down and work with us? So it was kind of a big surprise. I never expected. You know, the chances are like, I don't know, 1 in 10,000 or something. So somebody has to win the lottery. Might as well be me.
We're talking with Kathy Thornton, former NASA astronaut, flew on the space shuttle 4 times. Before we talk about your work in space and the flights and the missions that you were on, you were talking about your education and studying physics at Auburn, which, by the way, is a beautiful place for folks who've never been there. It's an absolutely beautiful part of Alabama and a beautiful school. Can you talk a little bit about your schooling growing up? Were you encouraged to study science, or was that just something that interested you and you just pursued it? Or did you have parents or grandparents who said, hey, you should really do that?
Well, when I was in school, I don't recall a science lab before chemistry in high school. Hands-on just didn't happen back then, or at least in my schools. I can't say I was encouraged. My dad thought I should do something useful, and physics wasn't part of that. I'm really the black sheep of my family, to tell you the truth. I'm much different than everyone else. And, you know, I guess I just didn't get the word that girls don't do this. Or, you know, growing up with 3 brothers, if I got the word, it was, oh, yeah, watch this, would be my response. But I don't think we can count on that. I think that we need to be encouraging of kids from birth, basically. You know, kids are born scientists. They start exploring the minute they're born, even before they're born. They're exploring and learning. And I think our job is to not turn them off during years of education. And certainly we have to worry about reading and math and the other things that are tested. But, you know, science can actually be a motivator for both of those. You imagine kids read because they want to read science, or they do math because that's the language of science. And I know there's stories about Wernher von Braun, who's like the father of the space program in this country, said he was a poor math student until he discovered that he wanted to know how to do rockets. And then he had to learn calculus to do that and eventually became a calculus tutor and a pretty smart guy.
So studies have shown, we're talking with Kathy Thornton, by the way, of UVA and a former NASA astronaut. Studies have shown that when kids hit middle school, I was going to say medical school, middle school, something happens. That's sort of the dividing line. You know, you can have a 6th grader who's so into science, and especially a girl, and then they hit middle school, and then all of a sudden they start drifting away from science. What do you think needs to be done? What should we do as a country? Because we are truly science deficient. I mean, we're importing scientists now, and we have so many of our kids that just don't, you know, they'll play on the computer all day long, but for some reason, we can't get them in a lab. We can't get them excited about science.
Well, that's a really tough question, and I'm not sure I can give any answers to that. A lot of things change in kids in middle school about what's cool and what's not cool.
Yeah.
But I think overall, we have a larger number of kids taking physics in high school than we used to back in the day. A larger number of girls are taking physics in high school, which is typically the last science they take. So, you know, I'm not as discouraged as you might think we should be, although certainly to keep science interesting, to keep it relevant, to keep it part of their lives is very, very important through middle school and high school and beyond.
Yeah. And maybe we should make an effort perhaps to get scientists in the classrooms to have some of those cooperative partnerships with the local communities and schools and get some scientists actually in there talking to the kids more.
Well, that's great when it can happen.
Yeah. We're talking with Kathy Thornton, Associate Dean at the University School of Engineering and Applied Science and a former NASA astronaut. Tell me about your first flight. Could you even sleep the night before?
My first flight was a Department of Defense mission, and it was classified. And so a lot of the publicity and notoriety and whatever that goes with shuttle flights was kind of buried for us, which was fine with me. I thought it was the best kept secret in the office because it was so much more relaxed in the sense that you didn't have to worry so much about what you said on air to ground because it wasn't being heard by a billion people.
Right.
Did I sleep? Yeah, I think I did. When, you know, the decision is you make the decision to do it years before. And, you know, it's not like you step on the launch pad and you go, I'm not sure I really want to do this. If you ever see somebody turn around on launch day, that's the bravest person in the world because it's far easier just to go through with it. It's like you're being on a moving train. So I think I slept. I even fell asleep during some of the countdowns because there's really nothing to do but lie there on your back for a couple hours and tell jokes, and we've already heard each other's jokes. And so I did fall asleep more than once.
So your first mission was classified. What was takeoff like the first time? Because you read that it's a pretty rough ride, or was it rougher in the old days when you're on top of a capsule?
They pulled many more Gs when they were on capsules, and we will again when we go to the next launch vehicle. But the shuttle has two wings and a tail and a lot of complicated aerodynamics going on between the tank and the orbiter, and so it's limited to 3 Gs toward the end of ascent. So it's a much easier ride than what they experienced in Apollo. But it's still kind of... it's thrilling, I have to say that. There's a lot of vibrations for the first couple minutes when the solid rocket boosters are still attached, and then it smooths out. It's more like an electric cart ride, except the acceleration continues to build up until you're pulling about 3 Gs. The whole thing lasts about 8.5 minutes. You go from 0 to 17,500 miles an hour.
And gosh! And are you working during takeoff? Is there stuff that you need to be, buttons you need to be pushing, or somebody you need to be talking to? Or is everybody just sort of, is it sort of autopilot and you're all just sort of sitting back and waiting to get into space?
For the most part, it's autopilot. From liftoff to main engine cutoff, and the pilot and the commander are monitoring the engines and the guidance and navigation. One or two of the mission specialists, which is what I was, would be involved in that as well as far as monitoring and hanging onto checklists and being prepared in case anything goes wrong. Then there'd be a number of us down on the middeck who are just along for the ride. And you sort of look at your watch and go, let's see, 2 minutes, we're not going back to Florida. You know, 4 minutes, we're not going to Africa. You know, and sort of following those gates and when you'd passed them and just hoping to get to space that day.
My guest is Kathy Thornton, former NASA astronaut, flew into space aboard the space shuttle 4 separate times. She is now the Associate Dean in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at the University of Virginia, and we're honored to have her here. I've got a phone line open at 977-1070. If you've got a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. You also flew and worked, if I'm not mistaken, you literally worked on the Hubble Space Telescope. Is that right?
I did. When the Hubble was launched in 1990, it was discovered that there was a problem with the primary mirror. Hubble was designed to have service missions every 3 or 4 years, and so my flight was the first service to the Hubble, where we changed some scientific instruments and put in the corrective optics to improve its capability to better than what it was originally supposed to be, changed the solar rays, and we put in some other fixes.
Now, did that involve, that must have involved a spacewalk for you?
It did. There were two groups of us that did spacewalks. There were 5 spacewalks, so I did 2 of them. I was part of the even couple. There was the odd couple who did 1, 3, and 5, and I was part of the even couple who did 2 and 4.
Did you practice underwater? Is that, we see that on television sometimes, that where they have you underwater.
We did a lot of training underwater. I think probably 200 hours each underwater working on things.
Wow. So what's it like going out and walking out in space with nothing but a suit between you and the stars?
It's it's a lot harder than you would imagine it would be. When we train in the water tank, we're usually in a suit that has been used a lot. And so it's soft, sort of like an old tennis shoe. But, you know, imagine you're going outside and putting on a stiff leather boot. And the suit feels like that. It feels very stiff, very hard. Things that you could reach by bending the suit in training are a lot harder than when you get up there in the real world. And so it's, you know, it's first the thought is not that I'm going to get hurt. Although the doctors do see the highest heart rates just as you begin to go out. But I think the feeling is, oh, please don't let me mess up.
'Cause, and you have your checklist. I guess you have everything that you need to do, sort of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you're just going to follow that list. Is that right?
If everything goes well, you do follow the checklist. Exactly. You have one on your wrist that is mostly emergency procedures in case you were to lose communications with inside, but also inside the orbiter, there's someone with the complete checklist who's following every step that you do. We trained so much for Hubble that we were actually reciting the checklist to him. You know, you put your wrench on something, you knew exactly how many turns it was going to take and what the torque should be. And so there's an awful lot of that that we practiced so much. It was just in our minds. But then sometimes things don't go the way you expect, and you sort of improvise.
Did you ever have a moment where you were where you were scared? I mean, was there ever a moment in any of the flights where you were like, oh, shoot, what do we do now?
There were times when we didn't think we could accomplish the mission. I don't know that I was afraid for my life, because you're trained well enough, I think, to know how to deal with the emergencies that you can deal with. And the ones that you can't fix are just beyond your control anyway, so you just don't spend a lot of time worrying about it.
Interesting. Amy is on the line in Charlottesville. Amy, thanks for the call. You're on with astronaut Kathy Thornton. You go right ahead.
Thank you. I saw recently, I don't know if it was on the Learning Channel, that mission, like the NASA As We Leave Earth special or whatever, and to see you on the end of that arm working on the Hubble made me just nauseous. I can't fathom being stuck out in space on the end of this arm, and then you were holding on to the Hubble, like just kind of holding on to it, and or the shield that you were changing, and then they said kind of, you can let it go now. Is that right?
It is. And the interesting thing about being outside, particularly on the end of the mechanical arm, is when you train in the water tank, so you hook your feet into this device on the end of the arm, and as you're being moved around on the mechanical arm in the water tank, the torque just sort of pulls you out of it. So in training, I was always falling out of that thing. But you get up there in space, and I guess the first time I got in it, the way you stay in is you press your heels out very hard. I was pressing them so hard out, my legs were trembling. But you know, after a few minutes, you figure out you're not going to fall off. And in fact, if you're not looking as the arm is moving you around, you have absolutely no sensation of movement at all.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, so sometimes I was working on tools as I was being moved around, and then I would look up and I would be very surprised that I was not in the same place I was the last time I looked, because I had no sensation of being moved.
Gosh, interesting.
It's an honor to hear you talk about and describe this and to speak with you. It was just fascinating to watch. I was channel surfing and saw that, and then they were talking about like couldn't get the bay doors closed, and I mean, I think I heard the word bungee cord. I mean, they would close the top and then the bottom would pop open, and then they'd close the bottom and the top would pop open, and they could might lose the Hubble. It was just fascinating that you guys are trying to problem solve how to get out of there in the middle of it.
Yeah, that was one of the problems we did have, and it wasn't actually a bungee cord. It was more like a ratcheting strap. We called it a come-along. And all it did was provide enough pressure to hold one side in where they could get the other side locked. But it was there was concern that we could damage the telescope if we hooked it on handrails, that we could actually pull one of the handrails off if we made it too tight.
Amy, thank you for the call. We appreciate it. We're talking with NASA astronaut Kathy Thornton. She's now Associate Dean in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at the University of Virginia, and we are truly honored to have her here. What are your thoughts about space becoming like a tourist thing? We see efforts now, private companies saying, hey, we'll get you into space, and that day will certainly come. It's almost inevitable. It might not be exactly what you went through. It might just be sort of a quick arc, a big arc up there and have that weightlessness and then come back down. But what are your thoughts on that as that moves forward?
Well, I think it's going to happen, and I think it should happen. I think that we should turn low Earth orbit over to private industry, and that NASA ought to, in the long term, move on beyond that, get out of Earth orbit. The first flights will be suborbital flights. They'll be similar to Alan Shepard's flight, where it's just a lob up and a few minutes in zero gravity and then you come down. But eventually we're going to have people orbiting the Earth as tourists. We already have with the Russians. But we will have private companies running that, and we will have destinations in orbit. It won't be as cheap as going to Disneyland for the week, but
right.
You know, there are people who pay a lot of money to do adventure travel, to go to Antarctica, to climb Mount Everest, and it will be of that category, I think, of adventure travel, but it will absolutely happen.
Right, right. What's your most unforgettable moment on your four missions to space? Do you have the moment that when you're an old woman, you'll look back and you'll think, I'll never forget that moment?
Well, there are actually a lot of them, but probably the one that sticks in my mind most is throwing away the solar array on the Hubble service mission. I let that thing go, and it looks like, if you look at the videos that Amy was talking about, it looks like I sort of shoved it away from me, but I really didn't. I just sort of took my hands off of it, and it was very stable right in front of my face. The arm operator pulled me away, and then the pilot separated from it, fired jets in the orbiter to push us away from it, and the plume from those jets hit the solar array, and it bent it over double, and then it sprang back out. So this thing was flapping its wings and cruising and soaring over the Middle East, which is a beautiful place to look at from orbit. And that was amazing. I had the best view in the house on that.
Wow, that is something. We are honored to be talking with Kathy Thornton, NASA astronaut. And we're talking with Kathy Thornton. She is Associate Dean in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at the University of Virginia, where she earned her PhD in 1979. And she is a former NASA Space Shuttle astronaut, flew into space on four separate missions, and we are truly honored to have her here live in studio. If you'd like to ask her a question or make a comment, we invite you to pick up the phone and give us a quick call at 977-1070. Tell us about this recent workshop. It was a workshop or a conference. It was a big to-do at Stanford recently, and you co-chaired the event. This was outside of NASA. It's my understanding NASA did not call this conference, but we're talking about, over 50 scientists and astronauts and industry leaders who got together to share their thoughts about the future of space travel, the American space program. Tell us about the workshop, why it was held. You also testified before Congress about this very same topic.
Well, the workshop wasn't intended to be a big deal. It's actually supposed to be quiet. We wanted to have a group of sort of handpicked people that represented a breadth of or a diversity of opinions on what we should be doing in the space program, where should we be going. And, the intention was to come up with some kind of consensus and perhaps present it as part of the transition in the next administration. Because regardless of the outcome of the election, there will be a new administration. That was sort of what our intention was. Well, then it became public, and the outcome was published even before we had it, that we were going to trash NASA's plan, that we were going to say the heck with the moon, go to Mars, and all that. So none of that happened. Amazingly, 45 people who had could basically say whatever they wanted. They weren't NASA employees, most of them, and so they were not tied to the party line. But we pretty much endorsed the goals, the original mandate of the space exploration program, which was Moon, Mars, and beyond. What's happened since that was, number one, the money that was promised along with that mandate hasn't materialized, and number two, it's been limited to the Moon. That you can't even talk about going to Mars. In fact, NASA is prohibited legislatively from spending any money on planning for or technology development exclusively for a Mars mission. So, pretty much they are mandated now into a dead end. I mean, why would you plan just to go to the moon and not think beyond that?
Now, how did this happen? Because didn't both 41 and 43, President Bush Senior and Junior, both of them have come out and said, we want to see manned space flight, see our astronauts on Mars. This is something we want to shoot for and we got to go for it. And now, if I hear you right, we're not doing that, not spending any money on it.
Well, they are spending money on going to the moon, and I think that that's a reasonable first step. But what I find distressing is that it's not being considered as a step to somewhere else. It's being considered as an end to itself. And I think we've not been very good at supporting more than one program at a time. We basically have to pull virtually all support from the space station in order to go to the moon. So, one at a time is about all we do well. And so if we plan a permanent presence on the moon, then, that'll be it for a generation or two.
Yeah. And you use the phrase dead end. I've heard that we've spoken with Ed Murphy before, astronomer at the University of Virginia, and he's referred to the space shuttle program as a dead end, that we're now having to scrap it and move on to a different vehicle that is, I guess, is currently in design that will be, and the space shuttle will be something in the past. It'll just be in the museums. Your thoughts on that?
Well, the space shuttle was an incredible workhorse for 25 years. It's taken more people to space in less time for less cost than any other space program ever. It's the only one able to bring anything back from space, the only spacecraft ever that has been reusable. So it's been a pretty remarkable thing, but it's limited us to low Earth orbit. We are firmly anchored in low Earth orbit when you talk about space station or the space shuttle. And so it's time to move beyond low Earth orbit. It's time to go somewhere else, and we can't do that with a space shuttle. So as I said, we're not very good at running more than one program at a time, so the space shuttle will be retired in order to make plans for a new vehicle that can take us not just to the space station, but to the moon and Mars and beyond.
Right. And the current plan now, endorsed by Washington and that NASA is working on with this administration, is stop talking about Mars. We're just going to go to the moon. Is that right?
That's what Congress has said. The administration didn't. Congress has said that.
Okay.
It says, okay, we'll give you the moon, but don't talk about this Mars stuff.
Why is that, you think?
I think they probably didn't want to give them the moon. That was a compromise, would be my guess, but I'm not up there, so I can't really say. But I think it's short-sighted, because then you're not planning, you're not using the moon as a stepping stone. You're doing what we did with the space station. Back in the early days of space station, it was, the tagline was the next logical step, meaning a step to something. Somewhere along the way, we forgot it was a step to something, or forgot it what it was a step to, and it became a destination to itself. A permanent outpost in space was the new tagline. And we forgot where we were going with there, and so then it was not a stepping stone to anything else. It just was what it was. And so I hope that we don't do the same thing on the moon.
We're talking with Kathy Thornton, former NASA astronaut, now at the University of Virginia. So what would you, let's say you're in charge of NASA, what do we do? what's your ideal plan that you think makes the most sense to you, given your experience? You've been there. You've been in that machine. You've been in space. You know the politics of NASA. You know the people. What do you think, ideally, looking out long term, 20, 30, 50, 100 years, what should we be doing?
Well, I'm not ever going to be the head of NASA. And unfortunately, you know, the head of NASA and even the president doesn't have the power to do everything that we would like to do. It takes all of us working together to do that, including the Congress and those of us who can influence the Congress in any way. But I would hope that we would use the moon to learn what it is we need to learn to go to Mars and beyond. Long duration in space, dealing with some of the environments, building a habitat that will last for a while, and then move on. There are other destinations like near-Earth asteroids that we can go visit. Those would be longer missions. They would be farther away from the Earth, so you would have to deal with the radiation environments and other things you'll have to deal with to go to Mars. There are also some great places to put scientific instruments at what they call the Lagrange points that are between the Earth and the Sun, or on the other side of the Earth from the Sun. And we're putting telescopes up there and other instruments to send a crew there to either service or deploy something. And a lot of the principal investigators of those missions would like to have the option of having somebody being able to fix what they do. So those are all stepping stones that could be used for what we can use them for, to learn to go to Mars, and then, you know, whatever's after Mars.
Kathy, talk about this. You mentioned the radiation environments, and I think it's something that most people aren't familiar with. They think you can just get in a spaceship, and if you have enough gas, you can go where you want to go. But talk about that effect. That's a challenge that's going to have to be overcome when we talk about long-range space travel for human beings.
When you're in the vicinity of the Earth in low Earth orbit, we are shielded from a lot of the radiation by the magnetic field of the Earth. The higher you go in altitude and farther away from the Earth, the less shielding you get, to the point where you have none. And so you are experiencing a much higher radiation environment than we see here on the Earth. And that's something we'll need to deal with. The requirements now for crews in orbit, their own personal radiation exposure limit is calculated by what we think it would take to increase their chances of dying of cancer by 3% above what it would be normally. And I think that's an OSHA requirement. So they're treated like radiation workers in that sense. But it seems to me that as soon as you commit to strapping yourself on a rocket and being hurled into interplanetary space, your chances of dying of cancer go way down. So, I don't know. I think maybe we can relax that a little bit and take our chances. I would.
Is the going to asteroids versus the moon, how would that compare? For the folks who haven't even heard that idea yet, there are asteroids out there big enough we can go and set up bases on, right?
Well, I don't know that you would set up a base. You could go there, you could explore it, you could bring back pieces of it, you could learn a lot about it. And they're much farther away in general than the moon. We have had some small things pass between us and the moon, but in general, they're farther away. It'd be a longer mission. It would be, dealing with all the health issues that you would have to deal with to go to Mars.
And better practice then for going to Mars.
I think so. And a lot to learn. I mean, asteroids are the building blocks of the universe. They're things that you can learn from the composition of that.
How long would it take to go to Mars? Given the technology that we have now, if you put somebody on a rocket and said, okay, we're sending you to Mars.
It depends on how fast you want to go and how much propulsion you want to put behind it. But nominally, 8 or 9 months to get there. And then depending on how long you wanted to stay, it could be up to a 3-year mission before you get back.
Wow. That's really something. And we'll see that.
I hope we'll live to see that. I mean, it can happen. There's no question we can do it if we choose to. It's a question of when we're going to get around to deciding that that's important to do.
Right. And that's what's so amazing is we can do that. We can do that now. We have the money and the brains and the talent and the experience. We could do this if we as a country decide this is a priority for us. We think we should be doing this.
I think we could do it. I mean, do you think about when President Kennedy said we're going to send a man to the moon, and he did say a man, by the way, right, and bring him safely home to Earth within the decade. We had one 15-minute suborbital flight. That was our entire spaceflight experience, and he said we're going to the moon and coming back. I mean, that's an audacious step in 10 years. I mean, surely we can do something as audacious now if we choose to.
Kathy Thornton is the Associate Dean in the School of Engineering and Applied Science at the University of Virginia and a former NASA Space Shuttle astronaut. I've really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Charlottesville Right Now with Coy Barefoot. Charlottesville Right Now is broadcast live Monday through Friday on News Radio 1070 WINA from 4 to 6 p.m. Best-selling author and historian Coy Barefoot is the host and producer. To interact with Coy and his guests, you can call 434-977-1070. Coy can be reached at barefoot@wina.com. This audio download has been made possible by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit SeavillePodcast.com for more.